I want you to imagine a hurricane this morning, and I mean a real hurricane, not a sort of UK sort of strong wind. It's a bit blowy today. I mean the sort of thing where you can't stand up, where your car will be blown over, where buildings will be destroyed, where whole towns can be flattened. The sort of event that leaves people stunned and overwhelmed, where the ordinary stuff of life, eating, sleeping, become a struggle. The things that were safe and familiar are gone. The disorientation that goes with that. If you can imagine that, you're entering the world of Lamentations. It is a scene of devastation in this book. It talks about the sort of hurricane of suffering that engulfed Jerusalem in 587 BC. As the city was destroyed by Babylon, as we were thinking last time, after a siege of 18 months, that is why people were so hungry. That is what we read of mothers even eating their children. This was a horrendous period of suffering in the life of Israel. And just as hurricanes can be forecast, so this hurricane was forecast. For hundreds of years, God warned that this would happen if Israel continued to disobey. And in fact, right at the time, Jeremiah the prophet was continually warning the people that this would happen. But they didn't listen, and the hurricane of God's judgment resulted. And we looked a little bit last time at some of the horror of what they went through, and just thought of how contemporary this is. This is no different to the world we are in today. Thought how the Bible gives us reality. So often as Christians we try and make everything nice, but the Bible is far more real. This is actually what the world is like. We looked at some of the sort of trauma, the disorientation of their experience, but also looked at the response. This thing we call lament. And this it was the sort of little definition we came up with for what lament is. This is what is going on in this book, okay? If you want to know what lament is, well, it's what they're doing here. And we're saying it's this crying out to God. So you're looking to God. It's an act of faith in trusting God, but you're saying it's not meant to be like this. There's something wrong. Things are not as they should be, and we want you to do something about it. And we were saying that that is a right response. What we read here is a right response to suffering. This isn't weak faith. This is strong faith. And you get it again in chapter 2 and now in chapter 3. But there's an even greater intensity with what is going on here. You see, in the first couple of chapters, you have the writer, maybe Jeremiah, almost speaking like a reporter. He's like going through the city and describing what he sees. And we saw that sometimes almost the city cries out and says, you know, look at what's happening. But now in chapter 3, the writer says, I was there. I was in it. I am in it. I'm not just an observer of this suffering. This is what I have been through. I'm a participant in this horror. And it reminds us that suffering is never something vague. When we say a nation suffers, well, of course, a nation can't suffer. People suffer. Individuals suffer. And that's what's highlighted here. And yet his individual suffering, in a way, represents the suffering of the whole city. Later on in the chapter, he switches to we. He starts including others as if what he's going through is really just a sort of focused version of what the whole city is going through. It's as if the suffering of the whole city is sort of concentrated into this one man. A bit like the way you can use a magnifying glass to sort of concentrate the sun's rays. You can, you know, light a piece of paper in the summer as you do that. And here it's all being concentrated upon him. Let's get a feel of that. We can brush over this stuff too quickly. Look at the pictures he uses, because they are utterly shocking here. In the first six verses, he's talking about being harmed. And it's really, the idea is almost of a shepherd, and yet this rod that he speaks of, a shepherd's staff, is now not to protect him, it's actually used against him. He's being led in darkness rather than light. He's led in a place of barrenness. Then in verses 7 to 9, he describes being a prisoner. He's hemmed in. And of course, that literally is what happened as the Babylonians came. But it's also what's going on inside. He's describing the emotional suffering, the sense of being trapped. Verses 10 to 13, he talks about being hunted, as if he's under attack by vicious animals. But then also, a person is singling him out. Not just some random attack, but a deliberate, focused attack. A target for arrows. Speaks in verses 14 to 16 of being humiliated. He is mocked, even by his own people in the midst of this. That would fit Jeremiah very well. He's given bitter food to eat. Imagine starving, and then it's almost a mocking thing, isn't it, to be given bitter food. Food that gives you no pleasure, even though you are starving. And you end up with this picture of hopelessness. In verses 17 and 18, I've been deprived of peace. There's a complete reversal in his circumstances. He's lost what he once had, the prosperity and the peace. And he says, my hope, the splendor is gone, the hope is gone. That is a great hurricane of suffering. But the hurricane passes here. In verse 19, he's remembering the affliction. He's beginning to look back. The hurricane is passing. The clouds start to clear. And what he starts to see clearly is actually God. He's gone through the storm to get there. And that whole experience has helped him to see what is real, what is important, more clearly. And he comes to this conclusion in verse 22, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. In a way, he's saying, I'm still here. I'm alive. That's almost the conclusion he's come to. That's something amazing, actually, in this situation. And it's true to life, isn't it? Imagine if you had lived through some devastating hurricane. You'd seen the carnage around you, maybe other people killed around you. Your first reaction would not be, where's the TV? Or even, why did this happen? It would be, wow, I'm here, I'm alive. And here the sufferer realizes that is because of God's mercy. And because he sees God clearly, he responds rightly to what has happened. He laments. And he starts to instruct the people around him. This man that represented the people now speaks to them and acts on their behalf. He says in verse 40, let us return. Let us examine our ways and test them and return to the Lord. He's calling out to the Lord and he's helping the other people around him to do that. In other words, this terrible experience has matured him. He's begun to grow up. If you're a young person, how will you grow? How will you mature? How will you grow up? Well, one of the ways will be through painful experiences. It is through suffering. We normally do all we can to avoid it, and we're not to seek suffering for its own sake, and yet realize it can be those painful experiences, those dark times, that actually is how we grow. And here the man is forced to really face reality, to see what really matters, to see what is really important. And so in this chapter, perhaps this is why I've sort of really struggled with this week, is we get a taste of grown-up Christianity. This is difficult. This is complex. You read through this chapter and you scratch your head and think, well, how does that fit? How does that work together? There's ups, there's downs. It's like, to take a different image, it's a roller coaster. You have these contrasts. He says at one moment there's no hope, And three verses later, I have hope. Well, that is true to life. Our Christian experience can be complicated. But it's when we're brought through these sorts of situations that we do cry out to God, that we start to see God as he really is, we start to get the full picture of God. So often we have a cartoon version of God, a two-dimensional God. But here we see God as the real person. Someone that we cannot fully understand, someone who is complex. And so there's a sense in which this morning I want you to be confused. Maybe you'll be confused anyway, but not confused through my incompetence, but confused by the sort of contrasting messages we have here. In a way, we should be asking, reading this, how can God be bringing this suffering and be merciful? I don't understand. How can you say, great is thy faithfulness, against the backdrop of this ruined city? How can you bring those things together? I don't understand. That's exactly what the people here were thinking. But it's only when we start to ask those questions and grapple with those thoughts that we discover just how wonderful God really is. And I hope you'll come to see that this morning. And that's the beauty of a book like Lamentations. If you remove this from the Bible, if you remove this from Christian experience and say, oh no, this isn't how it should be, this is too difficult, this is too depressing, you will lose out on knowing God. You will lose out, actually, on knowing Jesus. Jesus is the God revealed in Lamentations. And so maybe the suffering that you are in may be causing you to cry out to God. It's been given precisely to draw you to God, so that you can know him. Maybe for the first time, maybe not yet a Christian, God is drawing you to him. Maybe as a Christian, he's helping you to know him better. So let's just look first of all how God does that through this experience of lament. The God who brings us to lament. To the point where we cry out to God. The first thing we're taught here is that God is in control of all the suffering. He is behind it. And this is utterly shocking, because I was careful before not to say who was doing these things in verses 1 to 16. It's he. Well, who is the he? Who is the rogue shepherd? Who is the jailer? Who is the hunter? Who is the one that grinds his teeth in the dust? The answer here is God. The Lord my shepherd has become the enemy. That is shocking, but that is what it is saying. Now, of course, the actual suffering that the people experienced here was inflicted by Babylonian soldiers. But the Bible never uses that as some sort of excuse for God, to sort of distance God from what is going on, saying, oh, it's nothing to do with me, it's just what these other people have done. God is not embarrassed by the existence of such suffering. He doesn't see that as some problem for his existence. No, time and again, the Bible insists that God has brought the suffering, he is in control of the suffering. But then you think, but how can God be good? Surely what the Babylonians are doing here is evil. There is cruelty. There is viciousness. And that is true. What the Babylonians were doing here was for evil reasons. They did it for their own purpose, their own evil reasons. What they did was wrong. And actually, as we read on, we discover that they will be judged for that. And yet, God uses their evil to bring justice. See, the writer here realizes in verse 38 that both calamities and good things come from God, and realizes there is a justice in what God is doing. Why should any living man complain when punished for his sins. He is saying God does what is right. And there's a very deep lesson we thought a little bit about last time, that in God's justice, suffering does result from sin. But it's complicated, because it's not always the sin of the person who is suffering. So because someone is suffering in a particular way, it does not mean that they have sinned in a particular way. They may be suffering actually for someone else's sin. That's one of the tragedies of a fallen world. And you have elements of that in this book. There's this questions as to why certain individuals are suffering as they do. Why is Jeremiah, the faithful prophet, suffering as he does? And yet, taking the nation as a whole, the destruction that was brought by Babylon was a just punishment on Israel's sin. How does that get us to lament? How does that get us to cry out to God? Well, we see, first of all, that God is to be feared. We are meant to be a bit scared reading this. We love to make God a teddy bear, a comfort blanket, someone we can control. But the Bible won't let us do that. I wonder, is this the God that you believe in, the God that we read of here? It's not someone that you mess around with. His judgment on sin is very real, is very terrible. And he wants us to take that seriously. Or to put it another way, God is the hurricane. A hurricane is pretty scary. Totally beyond our power to control. And yet there is a safe place to be in a hurricane. And that is right at the center. If you're right at the center of a storm, it is still, it is calm. And in a way, we have that in the Book of Lamentations. These verses in the middle, verses 19 to 39, are like being in the eye of a storm. There's a great hurricane of suffering all around in the Book of Lamentations, at the beginning and at the end, but here in the middle, it's like you're in the eye of the storm. And it's when you're there at the center that you discover something remarkable about God. From a distance, he seems so terrifying, you want to get as far away as you can. And yet the closer you get to this God, the more wonderful he looks. He is actually safest when you don't have him at a distance, when you're close to him. And so here the writer is drawn to God. So even though he's speaking so strongly about God here, this isn't hatred, this is love. He doesn't want God far away. He wants his prayers to be heard. But he realizes God is a God to be feared. And because he is so powerful, it means he is able to help. You see, if God was not in control of suffering, what would be the point of coming to him? He can't do anything. Why bother to complain, as it were? You complain to the person that's responsible, to the person that can do something about it. You know, you're making complaints to companies. Often you're talking to someone that can't really do anything, and you ask to speak to the manager or to someone else that can actually respond to your complaint, has the power to do so. Well, that's what's happening here. There's problems, there's questions that come when we say God is in charge of all of this, but it's actually the only point of hope, because he is then able to help us. And what is most amazing is that he wants to help. Even though, in this case, the people here were guilty. This is like a worst case scenario of suffering, where their suffering was precisely because of their sin. It's not always like that. But even in that worst case, God wants to show mercy. In verse 22, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. He's saying his love is shown in the fact that they are not treated in the way that they deserve. He is confident that the Lord is good. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in him. Three times you get that word good, beginning in verses 25, 26, 27. The good, good, good God. That's why he comes to God in this lament. What's the point in pouring out your heart to a God who doesn't care? He's coming to a God who is merciful. But maybe you're thinking, but how can he do that given what he's just been through? What gets him to this point of trust in God? And we discover it's because he learns how to remember. See, in verse 19, he remembers his affliction. These are the bad memories. These are like flashbacks that come into his mind, create a terrible trauma within him. How does he overcome that? Well, in verse 21, yet this I call to mind. In other words, he deliberately decides to think in a different way. He's in sort of emotional free fall, and he decides to put his mind on something solid. So often we say, oh, I can't help it. It's out of control. That's rubbish. We can decide what we will think about. And here he decides to think on what he knows of God. It's an act of the will. He doesn't wait for some wonderful experience to come upon him. He decides, no, I am going to think on this God. I'm going to recall something that I know. And we were saying that this very act of lament, this sort of ordering your grief, actually helps you to do that. It helps you to slow down and to focus on God. And it seems like the change in him is almost triggered by one word. Verse 18, he mentions the name of the Lord. He's been saying he up till then. God is at a distance. But now it's the Lord. That is God's name. And almost just naming God in that way brings light flooding in. Because the name is not just a label. It tells him what God is like. And given the language he's using here, I think he's remembering what God has said about himself. This is in Exodus 34 and verse 6. When Moses asked God to sort of proclaim his name. So if you like, if God had a Facebook page, this is what would be on it. This is how he would describe himself. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. The first big thing about God is his incredible mercy, his incredible love. And that is what this man clings on to. That's what he thinks on. It's a right remembering. And as he does that, you see his hope in God is in God. It's not in what God will do. So often when we say we're trusting God, what we're actually doing is we're wanting God to give us a particular answer. So if God gives us the answer to our problem, that's what we mean by sort of trusting God. But what he's doing here is something different. He's saying, I'm going to trust God whether there's an answer or not, whether I get the solution that I'm looking for or not. Even if things stay as they are, I'm still going to trust God. And so he says in verse 24, the Lord is my portion, his inheritance. That means what satisfies him. All he needs. It's a bit like young lovers, and it should be older lovers too, shouldn't it? That say, look, I don't care where we live. I don't care how much money we have. I just want to be with you. You ever heard people speak in that way? Well, that's how this man is speaking. He's saying, look, I don't care how many blessings there are or where we are or what's going on. I just want to be with you. You are what satisfies. And so that means he's ready to wait. Therefore, I will wait for him. And that's a jolly good thing. Because as you read on in Lamentations, you discover there isn't an answer at the moment. The hurricane returns. So he's going to have to keep trusting God. So do you see what God has done through this experience? He's brought this man to a point of lament as he faces the facts of his suffering. But as a result of that, he sees the mercy of God. And God reveals himself to him there. But he does more, because God shows actually how he is the answer to his lament. And some of this Jeremiah couldn't know. But we, looking back on this, can see it more clearly. So it's not just a God who gets us to lament, to call out to him. It's a God who actually comes and laments himself. We were thinking last time how amazing it was that God listens to the suffering of this guilty people. He records their words in his book. He could just say, well, what are you moaning for? It's your own fault. God doesn't do that. He records their suffering. But he does more than listen. He actually laments. He weeps over their suffering. You get a hint of that in verse 50, where the writer here says, in verse 49, my eyes will flow unceasingly without relief until the Lord looks down from heaven and sees. In other words, he's expecting God to react in the same way that he does. What I see brings grief to my soul because of all the women of my city. And he's saying, well, God isn't going to be any less compassionate. And he's dead right, because God makes this very clear in verse 33, which is actually the verse at the very heart of the book. If you want to know where's the eye of the storm, it's this verse, verse 33. For he does not willingly bring affliction or grief to the children of men. In other words, God is saying it's not meant to be like this. I don't want it to be this way. God doesn't bring affliction willingly. This isn't from his heart. If you like, God would be quite happy if he never had to bring any affliction. He has no pleasure in it. In other words, God is love. God is not anger. God is always love. That describes who God is. God will be angry, but anger is not who God is. Rather, the anger actually stems from his love. God shows a right anger against sin. Let me give you an illustration of that. One writer says, think of Rwanda in the last decade of the past century, where 800,000 people, it's a lot of people, isn't it, were hacked to death in 100 days. How did God react to the carnage? By doting on the perpetrators in a grandparently fashion? By refusing to condemn the bloodbath, but instead affirming the perpetrator's basic goodness? Of course not. Wasn't God fiercely angry with them? We would think something was terribly wrong if God was not angry with such actions. In other words, God isn't wrathful in spite of being love. God is wrathful because God is love. So when he's bringing judgment, it's because he is serious about sin, and he would not be loving if he did not. And if you like, the only reason there is judgment and suffering in the world is because we don't listen to God. If we did, there would be no need for it. And yet God uses that suffering to bring us back to him. So he says it here, he does not willingly bring affliction. But we see it even more clearly as we look at the life of Jesus. In the Bible studies a few weeks ago, we were noting how Jesus wept at Lazarus' tomb. And it wasn't just a weeping of grief, it was an anger. Jesus was really crying out at Lazarus' tomb, seeing the weeping, the mourning, the grief. He was really saying, it shouldn't be like this. This isn't the world I made. And then, as Jesus approaches Jerusalem, this is in Luke 19, verse 41. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. they will dash you to the ground. You and the children within your walls, they will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. It's Jerusalem again. This is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, 600 years or so after the one we just read about in Lamentations, the same city. And Jesus knows this, and he is grieved over the path that they're going down. He weeps over it. Notice what he doesn't do. He doesn't apologize. Jesus doesn't say, well, this is terribly embarrassing that this is going to happen. You know, it's a terrible mistake. It shouldn't be like this. No, he doesn't apologize. He doesn't say this is wrong. It is right. It is just. And yet, Jesus doesn't just say, well, it's just what they deserve, isn't it? He weeps. He is grieved that that is the path they've taken. It would be a bit like a judge sentencing a criminal to life imprisonment, weeping over what he had done. See, that judge wouldn't be saying that it was wrong what he was doing. No, it was a just punishment, and yet he was weeping that this was necessary, that things had come in such a way that this is what he had to do. That you can consistently say something is right and weep over it. And that is what God does as he sees our suffering. There is something right, and yet he weeps over it. He laments. But how does that help? You don't just want someone to weep. You need them to do something. But there's a problem, isn't there? Because if God, in his love, must deal with sin, he must deal with evil, and he also wants to show mercy, he loves to show mercy, how do you sort that out? Surely that's an impossible tension. Well, fortunately, God has more imagination than we do. And he has come up with an answer, because this is the final thing. He endures suffering. He doesn't just look on the suffering, he actually comes and enters into it. And that is the most remarkable truth that we discover in Lamentations. Look again at this man that sees the affliction of God's wrath. Remember I said he's an individual, and yet he represents the people as a whole. He's someone that suffers at the hands of his own people. He's someone that's mocked. He's hit. He walks in darkness. He's someone that is silent. He's stricken. He's pierced. He's afflicted. He's crushed. If you know your Bibles well, you will recognize that language. He is someone like the suffering servant that the prophet Isaiah describes. Someone suffering at God's hand for his people. So who is he really? Well, this is Jesus. You see, that shocking language you read of verses 1 to 18 is what Jesus endured. So if you go away and say, well, I'm sorry, God, I believe him wouldn't do this sort of stuff you've got here. I can't accept that. You have a problem, because you've created a God that cannot help you. Because it is this man's suffering, Jesus' suffering, that gives us our rescue, that gives us our hope. I said that this man in Lamentations was suffering, almost the suffering of the whole nation was concentrated upon him. Well, that is what happened to Jesus on the cross. In his case, he was innocent, utterly innocent. This was real undeserved suffering. If that is your problem of how can there be this undeserved suffering, well, look at Jesus. He is the prime example. He deserved no suffering. And yet he takes on the identity of the people, and it's like he becomes a sort of lightning rod of God's judgment against sin. This sort of lightning that would destroy us all is focused down onto Jesus. And he endures that. And that is what provokes the greatest cry of lament in the Bible. When Jesus cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He is crying to God, it shouldn't be like this. How can the Son of the Father be forsaken by the Father. That's a lament. And yet it's because Jesus endured that, that we can be forgiven. So it's only actually in the light of the cross that we can begin to make sense of what's going on in Lamentations. Of how God's judgment and how God's mercy can come together. How God can rightly forgive. And that's happened because Jesus said, I am the man, and suffered in our place. Jeremiah didn't know all that. The people of Jerusalem didn't know all that. But you're privileged because you do. I've just told you that. So what are you going to do with it? Is God speaking to you in your suffering? Is God drawing you? Let me ask you, who else can really help you? Turn to him. Be real with God about your sin. Realize the reality of God's judgment. And realize the amazing mercy of God. Remember, as you get closer to God, the more attractive he becomes. And maybe you already trust, but you're still in the storm. We'll look at that next time. The hurricane continues. There's not a simple happy ending in this life. So what are you going to do? Well, keep looking to the mercy of God. And where do you see that most clearly? In the cross. Recall that to mind. Recall to mind what Jesus has done. And if God did not spare his own son, how much more will he not give us all things with him? We look at the cross, we see the heart of God. So if you're questioning God's love, if you're questioning God's purpose, if you're thinking, how can this be right? Why am I going through this? Call to mind the cross. Call to mind the love of God displayed there. And say with Lamentations 3 that the Lord is my portion. Therefore I will wait for him.